I'm not happy about the fact that the propaganda model works better. I'm not really happy about it at all. And I urge those of you that share this unhappiness to throw your support to all those forms of alternative and non-commercial media that, in my view, give us hope for a better, in fact, a real democracy and future.
That's Edward Herman, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Edward Herman on the propaganda model. In liberal democratic societies, it has long been understood that the use of force to control the population is generally not a viable option. Therefore, controlling what people think is critical. Thus, an elaborate system of propaganda is needed. For that system to be effective, it must appear invisible. In totalitarian states, there is no ambiguity. Citizens know they are getting the party line. But in countries like the United States, where ownership is private and formal censorship is absent, there is an appearance of a free flow of information. However, that flow passes through successive filters, leaving only the cleansed residue fit to print. To talk about these issues is Edward Herman. He was an economist who taught at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He was also highly skilled at exposing media lies, fabrications, and propaganda. He was the author of many books, including The Real Terror Network, The Politics of Genocide, and The Myth of the Liberal Media. He was the author with Noam Chomsky of Manufacturing Consent, one of the most influential books on the media ever written. He passed away in November 2017 at the age of 92. This classic from the AR archive, recorded in Austin, Texas in 2001, is broadcast in tribute to our friend and ally, Edward Herman. And now, Edward Herman, the propaganda model.
The propaganda model is a model that tries to explain how the mainstream media work and to explain their news and editorial outcomes. It's based on the common sense idea that those outcomes are going to reflect important structural facts, that the people who own and control media institutions and others capable of influencing the media will use that power to shape what the media do. After all, what the media do is very important, and many of us would like to shape media choices, but only a small fraction of the population can do that. In fact, some people actually buy media properties to use them to serve their political interests. Now, the components of the propaganda model suggest who it is who can really influence the media. One is the owners who control and select and direct personnel. They also can fix policy, and most owners do fix policy in some degree. Some of them fix it in some detail. Some of them fix it, for example, just to say, we are going to concentrate on making money, which, of course, has consequences in what the media does. But it's very much underrated that the owners can actually affect what the media do. In fact, when you read conservative commentaries on the media, it is always very amusing to see how they pretend that, for example, Dan Rather really controls CBS or Viacom, and that he really is the dominant force. When they talk about the liberal media, they always talk about the people at the end who are the hired hands. They never talk about the people who own General Electric, who owns a network, and they never talk about Rupert Murdoch. And in fact, Rupert Murdoch, a couple of years ago, joined with another big media mogul in deciding to put up a news network on the grounds that the left controlled the media. Rupert Murdoch, who is an absolutely dominant media force, who owns a lot of media, makes important media decisions. Here, this man has the audacity to talk about left control of the media, that he has to take some special precautions to actually control, to offset. Okay, never underestimate the importance of the owners and their influence over policy. A second element in the propaganda model is advertisers who fund the media who they fund the media, that's incredibly important. So they have to be satisfied by the media in some way. In some, they don't usually exercise any crude, effective role in influencing the media, but they sit in the background as the people who must be satisfied. And one, if you ever read serious books on how the television networks operate and the details, you see they all have a large contingent of people whose function is to deal continuously with the advertisers and explain to them why the programs that they offer are suitable and will provide a conducive selling environment for their advertising. Another third element in the propaganda model is sourcing. And the essence of the idea behind this as a part of the control machinery is that there are more or less important sources for the media. The important sources are the sources who offer the media credible information and easy information, and from people who are actually making the news. So all the news people, as you well know, have people, stage correspondents stationed at the White House, they have Pentagon correspondents, State Department, local police department, they have ones at General Motors Corporation. And the really big people who make important decisions in society are people who are primary sources, and in media, technical media language, we sometimes call them primary definers. They define the news to a very important degree, and the media have to attend to them, and they do. They cultivate them, and eventually they frequently develop symbiotic relations with these primary definers, and so and they will actually go out of their way to accommodate them, which brings me to the fourth element in the model, which is FLAK, F-L-A-K, which means negative feedback. And negative feedback affects the media it affects the media only if the people who offer that negative feedback are fairly important and can hurt the media. If you write a letter to the New York Times and complain, it's not going to affect the New York Times. But if the president of General Motors writes a letter to the New York Times, they will look at it with extreme care. And what happens in this society is that because you can influence the media by this negative feedback, people with a lot of money and power actually go to great pains to make sure that they will make their positions felt. We even coined the phrase, I think we coined the phrase, flack machines. They organize flack machines like Accuracy in Media, which is an institution that was formed about 20 years ago, and its function is to follow the media and to write nasty letters and to really put pressure on the media when the media do things that Accuracy in Media doesn't like. And it's funded by large corporations. At one point when I last looked at it, 8 oil companies were among the funders of Accuracy in Media. But of course, flack also comes from corporations, from advertising agents, but it also comes from elements of the government. For example, the Pentagon monitors television more or less continuously. And they have a huge public relations and operation. And when they're crossed, the media learn about it and they feel it. So the possibilities of using flack is a function of power, of your financial resources and your ability to really mobilize them in order to keep the media in line. Now, the fifth element in the propaganda model is ideology. In the 1988 book, we just listed the anti-communist ideology, anti-communism as an ideology that was really controlling, and it was for a long time an incredibly powerful ideological instrument. It was one that the conservatives could always whip the Democrats with. The Democrats were always accused of being easy on communism. So usually found when the Democrats would come into power, they would feel so compelled to prove their anti-communist credentials that they would frequently behave more violently than the Republicans. But communism is now more or less dead with the fall of the Soviet Union. It's a very tough ideological element. I don't think it's that anti-communism as an ideological element is dead, but it's weakened. But its place has been taken by another wonderful ideological element, the free market. The fact that the free market is a wondrous instrument that it properly displaces the government for almost all things but the police and the military establishment. They're just about the only things for which the government is needed. It's a powerful ideological force, and it can be mobilized for a lot of corporate purposes. Well, those are the things that we put together as the elements of the propaganda model. You can look at them as kind of filters by which we mean that if some new possibility arises, for that to become news, it has to be able to be acceptable to all these elements, or that's putting it a little crudely, but if the proprietors don't like it because it's contrary to policy, or the advertisers are furious about it, or if it's feared if it comes from sources that are not credible and would be questioned and might generate flack from the flack machines, or if it's contrary to basic ideological principles, it's very hard to get it into the media. It gets through once in a while, no doubt, but these are filters that can be very powerful. On the other hand, when things come through that the filters all approve and even like, maybe it's possible even to generate a propaganda campaign based on them. For example, the plot against the Pope, one of my favorites, which I wrote on many times in 1981 when there was an assassination attempt against the Pope, and some Turk who was in jail was eventually, it was arranged for him to say that the Bulgarians and the KGB did it. The media loved that. And it fitted the evil empire campaign, the Cold War, and it was therefore lovable. It passed through all the filters. And it was possible to have a propaganda campaign based on a nice contrast that I've always been fond of is this, that in 1980, 81, Solidarity came into existence, and it was under real pressure from the communist government of Poland. Well, the media took that up with, of course, officials in Washington said, oh, this is very bad, this is terrible, this is a violation of freedom. And the media got on a tremendous bandwagon campaign of concern over Solidarity. It was a very powerful campaign. But the funny thing is, in the same years, a Turkish military government took over that started a crackdown on Turkish trade unions and actually committed more violence against them than the Polish communist government did against Solidarity. But if you go back and read the media, you will hardly know that anything was happening in Turkey to the Turkish trade union, because Turkey was our friend. It was a beloved friend. It was anti-communist. It was allowing us to have military bases in Turkey. This military regime was also pro-free market. It would allow market entry. What more can you ask? So this kind of information didn't go through the filters. The advertisers wouldn't like it. The proprietors wouldn't like it. The government wouldn't like it, and therefore the flak machines wouldn't like it. And it also didn't fulfill the ideological requirement that's the attack on Solidarity film. Anyway, it's a very nice little dichotomy. You could also say the same, you could see the same thing right in the last few years with respect to Turkey. Turkey, in the 90s, has carried out an ethnic cleansing against the Kurds in Turkey that makes what Milosevic did in Kosovo in 1999 look like peanuts. There are maybe 35,000 Kurds killed, several thousand villages destroyed, 2 to 3 million refugees, tremendous ethnic cleansing. Whereas in Kosovo, according to U.S. official figures, something like 2,000 people altogether on both sides were killed in the year leading up to the NATO bombing based on our tremendous moral concern over those victims of ethnic cleansing. Well, here again, some Serbia had become had joined our hit list. We had various political and geopolitical reasons for going after them, and therefore the media got on this bandwagon. Whereas Turkey, the Clinton administration was supplying Turkey with the most remarkable collection of arms all through the 90s, as this ethnic cleansing proceeded. But you would have to read the newspapers extremely closely to know that anything was going on, and especially that we were supplying Turkey with these arms. Well, the model, the propaganda model, is really a free market model. It's not a model of centralized decision making. It doesn't involve any conspiracy whatsoever. The media don't need to conspire. They all operate on the basis of rather similar principles. Sometimes the government may take a lead and give them some guiding principles, but sometimes not. When the plot against the Pope came, actually the lead was carried out by the Reader's Digest and Claire Sterling and some other people like that. But frequently in foreign policy, the government gives the lead and the media follow. And they do that not by any conspiracy whatsoever. They do it because they use the filters work. They're sourcing as government officials on these matters, and they have internalized ideological beliefs that make them jump to the support of the government policy very easily. Now, one other thing I want to say about the propaganda model is it does not purport to explain everything, no. But it works best when the government and the corporate community are in agreement on important corporate and important corporate interests are at stake. There's an analogy here with the analysis of how the political system works in the book by Thomas Ferguson called Golden Rule, which develops what he calls an investor theory of party politics in the United States. Ferguson argues that investor interests dominate party politics in the United States, and that party differences are going to be a function of which investor interests are most powerfully influential in the various parties. But the important point from the standpoint of the model that I'm talking about is he says where all the investors agree on an issue, the parties won't compete on that issue. They'll be silent. Take, for example, the military budget. The corporate community, the Pentagon obviously loves the big military budget, a very important part of the government. The State Department likes it because it's the base for American foreign policy. The contractors like it. The transnational corporations like it because it's an instrument for carving out power positions overseas for American transnationals who are very important. So there's sort of a quiet consensus among the really powerful people in America that this gigantic military budget, which is five times larger than the shrinking Russia, it has so shrunk that it's the size of the Netherlands as an economy. But obviously we need this gigantic military budget for purposes of, quote, national defense. Defense! I put the stress on the word defense. But in any case, Ferguson is making this very important point about where the investors agree. And the investors agree that we need this huge national defense budget so the parties don't compete in that. You will notice that Al Gore and George W. Bush, both of them, were all for the existing national defense budget to be grown. They were competing. Gore was denying that he and Clinton, who had pretty steadily increased the budget, were stinting on the military budget, and Bush was saying he wasn't going to go further, but they both, none of them thought the budget should shrink. Of course, the general public usually thinks the budget should shrink. In fact, almost all studies that really go in deeply into what the public thinks about budgets, except in times of dire emergency, you know, when there's a war or something like that, the public always says we would prefer more education spending than defense spending right now, and we don't want to increase. One of the best studies that I know of is a book, a little thing by Stephen Cull called Americans on Defense Spending. He's a specialist in attitudinal surveys, and this study is really a very in-depth one. It was carried out in 1996, when, at a time when the military budget was increasing, and he found at that time when the budget was increasing, the public, by a huge majority, wanted it to fall. And the trade-offs are, as I said, they would like a shrinking military budget. They would like a lot more for education expenditures. But this is irrelevant because the investors disagree. and therefore the parties are not going to compete. Now, Ralph Nader, of course, did say he would like to cut the military budget, but you know what happened to Ralph Nader. He was marginalized, and the papers, in my favorite editorial in the New York Times, they said he doesn't even need to participate in the debates because Gore and Bush have great differences, and they are adequate. They're adequate. So if the New York Times editorial board thinks that, then the public can go get lost. And we don't need to discuss the issue further. But notice the link here. Here's the corporate community agreeing we needed this big military budget. The parties won't compete, as Ferguson said, and the media find that this is fine too. The media, in fact, if you look more deeply into how the media have treated the problem of military expenditures and in the last 5 years, you will see they do not give a lot of attention to the military. But when it comes through, you will see that it's usually a back page entry that just says, well, they just passed this budget for $290 billion, and no discussion in the media. Occasionally there's an editorial that says maybe it ought to be cut a little, but they do not give it. For example, Monica Lewinsky got much more attention than the military budget for the last 20 years. If you added up the lineage for Monica, the military budget, $300 billion a year, quite a lot of bucks, but it's not worth discussing. And you don't need to have a candidate who wants to put this up for debate. So Ferguson's point flows into an analysis of the media. And of course, the propaganda model is explaining that too, because with these filters in place, the military budget is not a newsworthy item. The same thing would apply to free trade issues. The corporate community was all for the North American Free Trade Agreement. They liked the World Trade Organization. And when the North American Free Trade Agreement was being debated in 1993, again, you had this very interesting phenomenon that the corporate community was all for it, the elite. In fact, polls showed that the higher the income bracket, the more likely you were to favor the agreement. But since the lower orders are more important quantitatively than the elite that supported it, the polls always showed that the public didn't want the North American Free Trade Agreement passed, even though there was a huge media barrage supporting it. From the beginning to the end, the polls showed public would vote against it. But that didn't affect the situation. In fact, even the Democratic Party in Congress and Senate was against it. But Mr. Clinton was for it, and the Republicans were for it, so they were able to get this thing through. So here again, you have the corporate community for it, public against it, but the media basically were supporting it. In fact, I always was intrigued by the fact the media almost never talked about the polls. The polls really showed up in remote places. They never liked to feature the polls because it was very awkward. They sometimes did mention the fact that there would be losers, like women, the black people, minorities. You know, when they added up all these special interests that they said would benefit, it comes out to a majority of the people. And of course, the majority of the people, in fact, didn't want it. But sometimes the press would say, but all the experts agree that it's good. And also, if the public doesn't like this, they're misinformed. And they're special interests. But the media bias here was quite staggering. One beautiful illustration of it was the fact that the Washington Post and New York Times both had editorials castigating labor for actually having tried to stop the North American. And they gave a list of congresspersons who had actually voted, who might have been influenced by the trade union, by labor. You know, they were really saying, labor, you don't have any right to participate in the political process in this country. It's only the substantial citizens that do, and you're not part of them. They never raised any questions about business contributions. Even the Mexican government pumped $30 million in public relations money into this country to try to influence. New York Times and Post didn't complain about some foreign country trying to influence the political process here. It was really quite mind-boggling. But in any case, the point holds that here, where the corporate community really wanted something, free, quote, free trade. It's not really very free trade. In fact, the North American Free Trade Agreement, if you ever look at it, 90% of the text is about the rights of investors in Mexico, or rights of investors in one of the countries, which you read have to read is Mexico. It wasn't about trade. It was about investor rights and protecting the rights of investors from any adverse policies that they might encounter if investors went into that country. It was a really, but it's nicer to talk about free trade. That sounds good. We always like things that are free. Free trade. I mean, if you talked about it as investor rights, that wouldn't sound really very good. So we'll call it free trade. So in any case, the media loved this. They wanted free trade. They were for it. And again, the propaganda model can explain this beautifully. It also can explain very nicely the way the media treated the events in Seattle and Washington, D.C., when the World Trade Organization was being protested, and then the World Bank and IMF. Media did not like the protests, and they vilified them, they falsified the facts, they a lot of them, inverted the process of violence. The violence in Seattle started with the police, not with the protesters. But you will find the media continuously talking about the violence of the protesters eliciting the defense and response of the police. And they were very little critical of the police. And in fact, they were so awful, outrageous, the media in both Seattle and then in Washington, in allowing the police to do dirty tricks. Things got actually worse when you had the Philadelphia Republican Convention and Democrat. The police got more and more ruthless because they knew the media would not protect free speech. They would exonerate the use of pepper spray against unarmed, just simple, ordinary protesters in the street. So the media were really treated these protests with, in my opinion, opinion of a lot of other media analysts, with real hostility, and also violating fundamental principles of media processes. Namely, they almost never said what the protesters were protesting about. They treated them as troublemakers, as people who had no coherent programs, when in fact very large numbers of them and many large groups who were sponsoring these had very coherent analyses, far more profound than Thomas Friedman in the New York Times or any of these other hacks. But here's where you have a really truly undemocratic media that will feature and even feature falsely the violent sequence, and play the old game they used to play at the time of the Vietnam War protest, looking at the protesters' clothing and paying attention to little oddities like this, but ignoring substance. It was outrageous, but the propaganda model, I hate to come back to that, it explains it very nicely. These people were against what the corporate community was devoted to. Quote, free trade. Always remember, I use free trade in quote marks. Take another illustration of where the propaganda model may apply. Take the chemical industry. One very important historical event in the history of the media's treatment of the chemical industry was the publication of Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, back in 1962. The book was sensational in this respect. It was the first time that somebody hostile to the chemical industry ever was the main feature of a national television program on CBS with 10, 15 million people watching, where she set the agenda. That was incredible.
You're listening to Edward Herman on the propaganda model. This classic from the AR archive was recorded in 2001. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Before that, there were some occasional protests about with chemicals and letters and this and that, although the Silent Spring, the title of her book, was already evident, and the costs of chemicalization were really evident in many, many places. But those protests were never pulled together. They were never organized, and the media never gave them a lot of attention. And they never gave somebody who was talking about an epidemic in slow motion, they never gave them front and center to spell out an analysis of what was happening to us. It took this book, and this book came at a very important moment in time, partly because there was accumulating evidence of birds being killed and there being a silent spring, but also this happened right after the thalidomide disaster, where a thalidomide drug had been used and with tremendous horrible casualties among children. So there was an environment that was sort of welcoming. Also, the Kennedy administration was in power, relatively sympathetic, had some people relatively sympathetic to some kind of critical view. And there was a spate of discussion that time about whether we didn't have to do something about the chemical industry. But basically nothing was... Well, another thing I should mention is that the chemical industry got very hysterical over Rachel Carson's book. And they tried to block CBS, they got advertisers to withdraw advertising. They were really incredibly heavy. Shows how bullying they are and how spoiled they were. They were so used to having their way that to have an alternative viewpoint pushed over national was intolerable to them. So they used dirty tricks immediately. Get advertisers to pull out. They had numerous articles and reviews vilifying her as emotional when she was very sedate and very, very... quite a scientific, scholarly type of person. And anyway, they tried a real smear tactics. But they claimed after the fact that they'd learned their lesson. And the lesson they learned is to just forget about it and just let it quiet down, because the media will not pick it up. They'll let it be episodic. It's not like Monica Lewinsky, for God's sake. There, you've got something important. Or Clinton's pardons. I mean, there's something really important too. So those things you can work over more or less endlessly. But chemical contamination of the human population, I mean, that's not worth it. Or rather, the industry is so damn powerful that the media will not do it. The power of the chemical industry can be indicated by, well, you can look at their profits. They're a very profitable industry, one of the most. But of the 100 largest advertisers in the United States, 30 of them made chemicals. 30 of them. So obviously the chemical industries have bankers, investment bankers, commercial bankers, advertising agencies. They're even on the boards. I once did a little computation. If you look at the boards of the major companies, the Tribune Company, the Washington Post, New York Times, they almost all have a representative from a pharmaceutical or chemical company on the board of directors. These people are people with muscle. They have financial muscle, and they can generate flack, and they have links to the proprietors. They're part of the advertising system, and therefore... The propaganda model would say it's going to be very tough getting something deleterious, even if of fundamental importance, on this in the media. What you will need is a catastrophe, like the thalidomide thing, or some fantastic event, like a great book, like Silent Spring, or the Bhopal disaster, where all of a sudden 1,000 people are killed by a little leak of a chemical by Union Carbide in India. Well, actually, after that leak, and then there was another leak of the same chemical in West Virginia, Congress finally passed by one vote a bill that required that chemical companies will have to release evidence of their dumping into the environment 654 named chemicals. Before that, they didn't have to give this what is called a toxic inventory. They could just keep it to themselves. And in fact, the basic phenomenon, fact about the chemical industry, in fact, the phrase in Rachel Carson, that is a beautiful phrase, is that the American system is poison us and then police the results. That's the way the chemical... Poison us and then police the results. Meaning that the chemical industry has a right to produce chemicals, pump them into the environment, and then we'll look and see if there's any bad effects and police those results. That's the way the system worked back in 1962, and that is the way the system still works. Because the chemical industry still, the pharmaceutical companies, now do have to make safety, do safety tests, and submit those to the government before the company uses, puts these into the environment. The chemical industry still doesn't have to do that. They can pump the chemicals into the environment. Now, they are supposedly required to test and to give the results to the EPA. But there's no way to check that they do this. And in fact, there was an amazing incident back in the 1980s when Monsanto had been in a squabble with the EPA. And the EPA, looking in the records, found there was a rule that said that if the company, there was a legal rule, like maybe it had been a regulatory rule, that said that if a company that does a test, and this test shows some problematic features of the chemical, they should submit that to the EPA. Well, in looking at Monsanto, they found that Monsanto had 156 such studies which they had failed to submit. And well, they forced Monsanto to cough these up. And at that point, the EPA recognized that this rule wasn't working. The chemical, here's Monsanto, refusing to cough up until they finally, by a fluke, discovered they had 156 studies that were relevant. Well, they decided, gee, maybe we better do this. What we'll do is we'll declare an amnesty for all the chemical companies. Say, we will not punish you. They're supposed to get heavy fines. And Monsanto itself got a fine that was about 1/20th of the one they legally should have gotten. It shows how tough the EPA is toward these chemical companies. But they announced this amnesty. And they told all the companies, we have 3 years to give us all these reports that you may not have sent in. And we will not punish you for it. They got 11,000 reports sent in of reports from the chemical companies of tests that had showed some problematic features that the companies had not. Well, that's really rather sensational. The media didn't pick this up at all. And there are 100 other cases of this sort where the media are not interested. And the media, in fact, pretend, like the chemical companies, that the EPA and, of course, the FDA are really powerful institutions that are really watching the public welfare, when in fact they're pathetic and they're underfunded. And in fact, the chemical companies see that they're underfunded so that they can't do any serious policing. And they also, since these chemical companies are powerful enough to affect the media, they can also affect the regulatory process itself, and they can affect what the laws say. They can affect who the regulators are. And you may or may not know that in the Reagan era, he pumped into the head of the EPA some lobbyists for the chemical companies who ripped the EPA into shreds. So that's called regulatory capture. And it happens very frequently in regulatory systems. It's happened to the EPA. And when it doesn't, even when it doesn't happen, the chemical companies can exercise a lot of political pressure and threaten and keep even the quote, liberal administrations of this authority in a weak condition. So the chemical industry has had this power to maintain what you would have to call producer sovereignty in this business. They're free to poison us, and we'll have to police the results. And the media do not play it very heavily. If they have a Bill Moyers-type program once every 10 years, maybe, and if some sensational event occurs, the media will pick it up, and they will drop it quickly. But the propaganda model explains this beautifully. It also, a related thing is, take this, the climate, the problem of global warming, and the Kyoto Agreement and the Hague thing. Here again, the corporate community, especially the oil companies, coal companies, a lot of the very powerful companies in America, do not like the idea of cutting back emissions because it's going to hurt their profits and business, and they therefore have been fighting it. Some of them are moving over. Some of them are quote, responsible and have actually stopped positively opposing these things. But there are a whole bunch of them that are violently opposed, and they have various groups. They hire scientists to give corporate junk science to prove that it's not clear that there's going to be global warming and so on and so on. Well, at Kyoto, there was an agreement that by 2010, we were going to reduce emissions by 7%. Well, our government then goes to The Hague, and at The Hague, the liberal, quote, liberal Clinton administration proposes what we will do is get the world to agree that we have these fat forests that are carbon sinks. And what we would want them to do would be to count all the carbon that's absorbed in the forest, which is a lot of carbon, as our contribution to emissions reduction. I mean, absolute sickening and high comedy. But then by bargaining, and the New York Times then said we were going to make concessions, you know, we were going to be reasonable and make it a go. And actually, if that had been followed through, if they'd accepted the American proposal, the emissions for 2010 would, instead of going down 7%, would have gone up by 30%. There were in Europe, in the European media, you could read these figures. They pointed out the American proposal wouldn't cut emissions at all. They'd go up 30%. But then we made a really sensational offer that we would cut it back to some smaller sum, where the increase in emissions, instead of being minus 7, would only be about minus 15. But if you read you will not find in the American papers, there was a very good article in the excellent magazine called Extra by a woman named Rachel Cohn on this deal. And she looked at all, I think she used the LexisNexis, and she they did a pretty thorough job. She claims that there was no American media institution that mentioned that the American proposal would actually increase emissions. That wasn't mentioned. And the New York Times actually presented our position as a reasonable position, without details, mind you, just as a general statement, and blamed the failure of The Hague on the lack of pragmatism of these green types in Europe. We're insisting that we follow through modestly and actually force emissions to be reduced. I mean, it was mind-boggling. I mean, it was actually, Orwell would have blanched to see what these papers are doing. But this is the American press. But again, it fits the model. The very important power interests don't like doing anything about global warming yet, and therefore the media are going to play this kind of miserable game. Let me talk about a foreign policy issue. The propaganda model in manufacturing consent, we use it only for foreign policy issues, but you can see that it's not bad for considering non-foreign policy issues, but it's still very beautiful when you look at foreign policy matters. And in fact, maybe it's even more important now to look at the media and its abuses in foreign policy now, because we've now entered this new age of a new generation. Here's a new, terrific new book by Chomsky. I'm even selling his book rather than mine. He's got a new book called A New Generation Draws the Line. That's incredible irony. He's being very, very ironical. He's quoting Tony Blair, this new generation that's drawing the line against doing nasty things to helpless people. And the subtitle, Kosovo, East Timor, and the Standards of the West. Well, the book is utterly devastating on the incredible hypocrisy of the foreign policy of the United States, and, of course, Britain, too. And he criticizes one point of some interest. If you read the new humanitarians who write about our wondrous behavior in Kosovo, and backing, you know, this devotion to preventing ethnic cleansing in Kosovo, some of them then have to face the fact, well, then in Turkey, we didn't do very much for the Kurds, did we? Or in East Timor, where Indonesia ran riot and allowed many, many more people to be killed before a free UN-sponsored free election that were killed in Kosovo by the Serbs. Yet we didn't lift a finger. He points out, well, the the new humanitarian say, well, we can't do everything, and so we'll have to tolerate something. But one point that Chomsky makes with force here is that we didn't just tolerate those things. We actually positively, vigorously abetted them. That in Turkey, as I mentioned, we armed the Turkish government very aggressively all through the 1990s while it was doing its dirty thing. And in Indonesia, we were training the Indonesian army almost up to the day of the referendum. And in fact, we could have called them off by just a telephone call. That's our client state. We supplied them with arms. Some of the Pentagon's best friends are running Indonesia, the Indonesian army. They could have called up and said, the game is up, fellas, you can't do this, please go back home and leave those people alone. We finally did that to a degree. After the election, Indonesia lost, more people were killed, the country was really virtually destroyed, and there was a lot of pressure on Clinton and his gang to do something. He had up to that time said, well, it's up to Indonesia. Nice. He didn't say that to Milosevic. It's up to Milosevic. Actually, it was Milosevic's country. I mean, Kosovo, I think things are really pretty bad in Kosovo, but at least Kosovo is part of Yugoslavia. East Timor is occupied country that the UN has still not recognized as part of Indonesia, and Indonesia has done horrendous things. It's in East Timor. So for Clinton to be standing there, and also after, it's well known that the Indonesians are doing terrible things right then and there all through the pre-referendum, and to say it's really Indonesia's business, that's really actively abetting. It's really saying, here, this is my ally, I'm not going to ask them to stop, I'm not going to cut off military training until the public relations requires it. And in fact, we started military training just a couple months after the end of that affair. Anyway, it's a pretty sickening picture, but Chomsky makes this very powerful point that we didn't just tolerate this, we actually aided and abetted it. But the media follow the party line in this area to an incredible degree. So they will swallow the notion that in Kosovo had a humanitarian intent, when confronted with the fact that we're actually using Turkey to bring about this stopping ethnic cleansing in Kosovo, when Turkey is really doing the same thing on a maybe larger scale, the media, actually, they never talk about it. When the new humanitarians are confronted, they say, well, we can't do anything. But the media basically just avoid the issue. And they're blind. They don't talk about Turkey and the Kurds. When they talk about Turkey and the Kurds, what they do is use another frame, namely, well, Turkey is fighting terrorism. Of course, that's what the Milosevic said. He's fighting terrorists, and the KLA could arguably be said to have been terrorists. And in fact, the funny thing is that in 1997 and 1998, the American emissaries in Kosovo actually called the KLA a terrorist organization. But then when we decided we were going to cream Milosevic and show him a lesson, all of a sudden they became freedom fighters. If you're reading the newspaper, you see that the KLA has now become terrorist again. It's trying to upset Macedonia and create a greater Albania. So they've done the full circuit. They from terrorists to freedom fighters back to terrorists. But the media don't argue this in this cynical way. They all play this all very cool. We were, in fact, working for the welfare of the Kosovo Albanians because this new generation draws the line. And we cannot stand that kind of ethnic cleansing. But of course, two serious problems. One is that the real ethnic cleansing only started after the bombing began. That's another point that Chomsky stresses, and that is very obvious. Before the bombing began on March 24th, things had quieted down. There were observers in Kosovo. There were international observers, and those people were saying things were under relatively good control. So, the Serb army and paramilitaries, they no doubt had a contingency plan. If we attacked them and there was a threatened invasion, they were going to go in and clear the ground, et cetera, and they did some really lousy things. But this was after the bombing started. So a superb case can be made that the only serious kind of ethnic cleansing there followed our actions. And in fact, there's some evidence that we even expected that, although we didn't do anything to get ready for to take care of the refugees. So the whole thing stinks from that standpoint. We created the real humanitarian crisis. It was a modest crisis, probably remediable previously. We created a real humanitarian crisis. Then the other interesting fact, once NATO took over Kosovo, you had a real ethnic cleansing. Because the Albanians, the KLA, these are real ethnic cleansers. They want a pure Kosovo. And they started to cleanse out not only the Serbs, but the Gypsies. The Gypsies were forced out of Kosovo under NATO auspices. Those Gypsies had not had any trouble in Kosovo when the Serbs were there. And in fact, the Serbs weren't even ethnically cleansing the Albanians before the bombing. They weren't doing. They were going after Serb. They were going after Albanian KLA people and civilians who supported them. They thought they were doing a lot of really dirty things. But they weren't ethnically cleansing. They weren't trying to expel them out of the country. But the under NATO, they were expelled out of the country. Now, that's really kind of funny, isn't it? Here we're going in to prevent ethnic cleansing. There wasn't any until we started it by our deliberate action, knowing that it was going to happen. Then we take control of Kosovo, and under Kosovo, some 350,000 people have been forced out of the country because the KLA was given something of a free hand, which is why they're now so competent and able to upset Macedonia. You don't have to just look at what NATO, what's attitude toward Turkey and the Kurds. Just look at what they did in Kosovo, and you have to really raise a question about whether the new generation was really trying to help the Kosovo Albanians at all. One last point here. I did do this computation on the New York Times on how the media use words. I'm very fond of analyzing word usage. And during the Kosovo attack, there was constant reference to the fact that the Serbs were committing genocide. And in fact, in the New York Times, I did this little study, the New York Times, in 1999, they used the word genocide in their editorials or news columns 68 times. 68 times. Now, for East Timor in 1999, where many more people were killed before the referendum and the country was totally devastated, and continuing a process where one-third of the population had been killed under Indonesian auspices from 1975, how many times did the New York Times use the word genocide? Zero. Not once did the word genocide enter their editorials and news. Now, the other beauty is this. Turkey, as I was pointing out, was doing nasty things to the Kurds. In the 1990s, how many times did the New York Times in its news or editorial ever refer to the Turkish treatment of its Kurds as genocide? Twice in the whole 1990s. But here's the real climax. Saddam Hussein in Iraq was also being nasty to his Kurds. Now, how did the New York Times use the word genocide? 26 times they used the word genocide for the Saddam, he's our enemy. Therefore, his treatment of the Kurds is genocide. Turkey is our one warm friend, our land-based battleship in that area. And therefore, they can kill freely, and they're never engaging in genocide. It's a beautiful system. The propaganda model works very well. And, in fact, it works better now than it did in 1988 because the structural conditions on which it rests have strengthened market control. Media commercialization and concentration are greater than they were. And also, competition for advertising and advertising power across all media boundaries has gotten more intense. So advertising power has also been enhanced. And as far as market ideology, as ideology goes, as I told you earlier, I think market ideology and the idea that the market is a wondrous instrument actually more than compensated for the post-Soviet weakening of anti-communism as an ideological force. I'm not happy about the fact that the propaganda model works better. I'm not really happy about it at all. And I urge those of you that share this unhappiness to throw your support to all those forms of alternative and non-commercial media that, in my view, give us hope for a better, in fact, a real democracy and future. That's it.
That was Edward Herman on the propaganda model. This classic from the AR archive was recorded in Austin, Texas in 2001. Edward Herman was an economist and a brilliant media analyst. He was the author of many books, including Beyond Hypocrisy and The Myth of the Liberal Media. He was the author with Noam Chomsky of Manufacturing Consent, a landmark study of media biases. He passed away in November 2017 at the age of 92. He was a friend and ally. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Noam Chomsky, Alfred McCoy, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Henry Giroux, Naomi Klein, Chris Hedges, and Nancy McLean. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Edward Herman on the Propaganda Model, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.